Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan labeled government a dangerous threat. Since then, a growing number of Americans have sought to limit so-called big government. As a result, many of the goods and services that we rely on, from water and trash collection to the justice system and the military, have been turned over to private for-profit companies. What are the hidden costs of privatization? How does turning over our public goods, such as education, transportation infrastructure, further economic, social, and racial injustice? Joining us to answer those questions and describe a path forward is Donald Cohen. He's the founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, an Oakland, California-based national research and policy center that studies public goods and services. His latest book is The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. So many define privatization as simply the outsourcing of a good or a service to a private company. You contend that it's much more than that. So tell us, what exactly is privatization?
Well, we define it as a very simple definition, but I'll elaborate, as private control over public goods, right? So handing over control. So you have to do a couple of other definitions. What do we mean by public goods, right? It's not the, you know, the economic textbooks have a very narrow definition. We have a broader definition. It's those things that, you know, are essential, that we need, that everybody needs to survive, to thrive, and we need everybody to have, like health, like education, like clean air, clean water, kind of, we can, like mobility, the ability to move around. And so when you hand over, and then the private control part comes with, you know, outsourcing, certainly when we hand off a water system to a, you know, contract that out, or a prison, or school vouchers, or any number of things, or custodians in a public school, when we outsource that to a subcontractor. That's certainly part of it. But, you know, but listening to the top of the news, you know, when we cut taxes on the wealthiest, and we, you know, which has been happening over the last number of years, and we don't have the resources to provide those essentials to everybody, or to make sure everybody has them, then, you know, we're left, you know, to the whims of the market. You know, childcare is an example I use. You know, I describe childcare as a fully privatized public good. Every parent needs it. And we need every parent to have it so that they can go to work and be productive. But, you know, for my grandkids and, you know, yours as well, I mean, they're kind of left on the market, you know, incredibly expensive to struggle to find good childcare for their kids.
Yeah. Public good, and then there are public goods, right? And the classic definition of public goods, you say, ironically, excludes the public. So how and what does your experience suggest is a better definition?
Well, like I was saying, so, and I'll take a second to say how the economists describe it, because it's they say they define it as two conditions: non-excludable and non-rivalrous things. And let me give a simple example: a streetlight. You can't prevent someone, you can't exclude someone from using the streetlight. They either see it or they don't. And so that's the exclusion. The non-rivalrous, if one person uses the streetlight to read their map, a person, you know, another person can walk right up and read their map as well. You can't, you know, it's basically unlimited, you know. Healthcare in that definition is a private good, not a public good. You can exclude people, we do, you know, lots. And there are only so many doctors and hospital beds and nurses and medical facilities as we're learning in COVID. So everything else in that, you know, in that definition is a private good, you know, it's a private good like healthcare. We say that, no, that can be determined, that the market shouldn't decide what we can do, what we could not do together. We should be able to decide that democratically. We should be able to decide as a nation, like many have, that everybody should have healthcare, access to healthcare, regardless of how much money they have. You know, wealth or income should not be a factor on whether you should get quality healthcare. And you could say the same for, you know, for all sorts of things. So, you know, the idea that we talk about in the book is that the public goods are what we decide everyone should have. Now, there are limits to that. You know, should we decide that everybody should have a widescreen TV, you know, in their home to watch Netflix? You know, I'd say no. I mean, well, certainly we could decide that. I'd say no. But I think we could pretty well come to a fairly reasonable decision together that we all need education, that we'd like everybody to get to college. We all need clean air. We all need clean water. We all need a shelter, you know, sort of all the things that we all need. And then it's just a question of how we pay for it. But the market, you know, the market can't provide those things if you decide it's everybody gets.
Some people push back against paying for the public goods they themselves don't use. For example, people without school-age children might not want to be supporting public education, or those who live in the suburbs might not want to pay for an urban public transit system. How and why has our perception of community and public good changed over the last 50 to 100 years?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, there's a section of the book that's, you know, organized to sections called community that has, you know, different, you know, examples and things in it. It's changed because, you know, we have shifted, and this isn't an accident. This is, you know, there's a, you know, politics and propaganda and all sorts of things have happened in this period of time. We've been shifting the definition of who we are. Is we are increasingly consumers of public services rather than citizens who get good public, who want and deserve high quality services, but have a broader responsibility to the, you know, to the whole. I mean, it's what's interesting to note is, you know, some may, you know, I think we've seen this over COVID, people ignore the, you know, this idea or don't believe it, that we're not just interdependent with, you know, we depend on each other as a value, as a community value, but we are in fact dependent on each other to get through the day. You know, for me, COVID has underlined the truth that the health of all of us depends on the health of each of us. So if you don't have kids in school, why should you pay for the schools? One is, it's who we are as a nation, that we want everyone to have access to kids. Two, if the cost is only borne by those with kids, it becomes expensive. That becomes, you know, you sort of shift into a market good, means people have less and less access to it. But it's also a complete truth that we need an educated public to survive as a democracy, to grow as an economy, to be able to, you know, to live together for in a number of ways. So it's in our social interest, it's in our economic interest, it's in our democratic interest for every child to be educated, right? Same thing is true of mobility and transportation. We need everybody to get around, right? And so even if you don't use the bus, it's in our interest for everybody to be able to use a transit system if they don't have a car or for whatever reason. So it's really important for us to understand the difference between, you know, what our identity as consumers and our identity as citizens. And that's, you know, the conservative ideas over the last 50 years and conservative politicians and others have really, you know, advanced that idea that now it's just about us as customers of public services, from, you know, from Reagan to Bill Clinton.
When we think of the public things that we all like, parks, fire departments, libraries, transit, why is it so difficult for us to articulate a coherent, convincing philosophy of the benefits of our public life?
Well, these are hard questions. why is it so difficult? I think in part for what I was saying is that, first off, we're in an environment, you know, again, over the last 40, 50 years that have been created that sort of against the idea, that have turned people away from the idea of government and the institution of government. That's not an accident, you know, since Ronald Reagan became president, you know, and he famously said, you know, the 9 most dangerous words in the English language are "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." You know, there's been a very concerted effort to say government is not for you. The government's for somebody else. Right. Famously, also Reagan in that period, you know, talked about welfare queens. Right? Those of us old enough will remember that. And what that was, examples of, you know, Black, you know, that was the implication, was clear. It was Black women who were having too many children or fraudulently getting extra welfare checks or whatever, kind of crazy stories. But what that was about was saying the government's about serving somebody else, not you, right? And by the way, it's somebody who doesn't even deserve it. It's the undeserving, right? And so, those ideas of it's about somebody else, it's not about us, have submerged the idea that, in fact, no, actually, governments actually and public services are literally all around us. You turn your head, the paint on the wall behind you used to have lead in it. It doesn't have lead because the public, took action. Federal government passed laws and regulations that it no longer has. It's made it healthier. The air, I live in Los Angeles, the air is cleaner than it was before the Clean Air Act was passed. There's no question about that. Turn on the faucet. I believe it's still a miracle. The water comes out, you flush the toilet, it's gone. It's truly miraculous in my view. So it's also, we're in this environment where we don't see, where we, there are public services and public things are both ubiquitous and invisible to us, right? So we don't see them. It's easy to, then we say, okay, but wait a second. We try to explain that to people. They go, oh, I didn't realize that. But it makes it more, makes it easier for us to say, okay, well, I only care about my kid going to school. I only care about this. The last thing I'll say is we're in a very divided nation. And as you know, that's, sort of so obvious, it's silly to say right now. But the less we do interact in those places, those public places, parks and libraries and schools, the easier it is for us to, or the harder it is, I should say, to make those arguments that we're all in it together because we don't understand each other.
Now, privatization advocates argue that government creates a monopoly whenever it takes on a service, and that monopolies stifle innovation, quality, and freedom. In contrast with privatization, we'll have a number of choices, and any lower quality offerings will wither away as consumers learn to avoid them. What's your response to that?
So, a couple of things. The private sector's more efficient. So there's several ideas in there. More efficiency, innovation, competition. So the first thing is remember that when if it's about outsourcing and contracting for to run a prison or a water system, the only competition that happens is to get the contract. Then basically what you're creating is a private monopoly over a public service, right? That's kind of what happens because some of these contracts are very long, some multiple decades, some 4 or 5 years, but that just get automatically renewed over and over again. So there's no competition that happens in that other than to get the contract. Now, what also happens is typically, I mean, usually or commonly, a company will do whatever they can to get the contract, lowball it, low bid it, get the contract, and then, realize they just don't have the reason, they bid too low and come back to the agency, which no longer has the internal capacity to do the work and say, oops, can you give us, can you give us a change order? Can you expand our contract? And, it's like as if you hired somebody to paint your house, they get halfway through and they say, oops, we underestimated how much paint we need. Do you want us to stop or do you want to give us more money? So governments are typically in that situation, happens all the time. So that's the, so let's ought to knock out the monopoly. That's how you deal with the question of monopoly. We have a right to deter, we have a responsibility to determine those public services are available to all, right? Either if you contract it out, we still have the obligation to make sure they're available to all at access. So it's not a question of monopoly. The other more important point, I think, is about competition. So competition, competition's a real thing. I didn't watch the football game last week, but lots of my friends did. It certainly creates positive things, but it also has negative outcomes. Competition and the profit motive, because they're often talked about at the same time. So let me talk about charter schools, which are controversial. There's some, I know Massachusetts had, ballot measures and debates about charters, and there's good charters and bad charters. That's not the issue. But here, and the original idea of charter schools, they're publicly financed and privately operated, often by a nonprofit, but and often those nonprofits hire a for-profit to run them. It's all those things happen. So the original idea was create laboratories of innovation, let teachers and parents and communities figure out new ideas and new ways to teach kids, and then share it with all schools. That's not what it's become. It's become a market model where, as you say, Schools will compete for, you know, for students and the money they bring with them. The good ones will succeed and the bad ones will fail. Now, so what's happened because of that, because of those incentive, that incentive structure, is several things. One is charter schools, cream and crop, it's referred to. They try, you know, the expensive kids or the hard to educate kids, they figure out what, you know, whether they have learning disabilities or behavior issues or English as a second language or whatever. They're just harder, they're more expensive, and they might bring down the school's test scores, which in the marketplace will say, well, I don't want that school, because that's how you measure. That's one of the ways you measure whether, you know, whether a school's good or not, you know, for better or worse. So they come up with schemes to push them out. You know, there was a principal in New York, in one of the charter schools, this is reported in the New York Times, had a quote, got to go list, the kids that they wanted to push out. And they figure out ways to do it. Oh, the school's not right for you, go back to the public school, all sorts of ways to keep the hard kids out. The second thing is private interests. You know, the competition is not about sharing, it's about secrecy, right? You know, McDonald's special sauce when I was growing up was a secret, was their trade secret. It was what made us all want to buy the Big Mac. So charter schools, again, we should be sharing that information. Many charter schools around the country ask their require their teachers to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, that they will not share the school's quote trade secrets when if they leave, or you know, whether they're or if they leave, you know, 'cause they could, and they could get sued. What are those trade secrets? Lesson plans, curriculum, teaching methodologies, exactly the things that need to be shared widely if they're successful. And by the way, we're paying for them, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I'll say one last thing about the profit motive, because it's all, you know, when I get these questions, you know, in debates all the time, is, you know, the profit motive has done good things, but it also created the opioid crisis.
We're talking with Donald Cohen. His latest book is The Privatization of Everything: How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Points. We're talking about the hidden costs of privatization with Donald Cohen. He's the founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, a nationally based research and policy center that studies public goods and services. His latest book is The Privatization of Everything: How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You make the argument in the book that our economic arrangements and how we live together publicly impacts our democracy. Would you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Let me, I mean, there's a few levels to answer that, but let me give an example about how privatization really is, in my view, is an assault on democracy in profound ways. It's illustrative. And so in Chicago in 2008 and 9, you know, the worst part of the recession, right? Everybody, every public agency and city, they're all bleeding red ink and facing very hard choices. What happened was on a Friday, the mayor at the time, Mayor Daley, announced a proposal by a consortium of three businesses, Morgan Stanley, a Wall Street investment firm, an investment firm from the Middle East, and a national parking company. And they said they'll give the city upfront $1.1 billion in exchange for control of the city's 36,000 parking meters for 75 years, till 2083. Let's just put that in our heads. Okay, vote on Tuesday. Desperate government is, you know, it's often said by those that want to get contracts, is their best customer. So the analysis and the investigation of the inquiry into the specifics of the contract happened after the deal was inked. So, I mean, two things were true. One is incredibly stupid way to borrow money on your future re revenue, on your, you know, who knows if we'll be parking, I mean, driving and parking in 2083. But even if that was the only way, they sold $1 billion too cheap. They just got taken, you know, but you just on the numbers. But that's not the important part. So for the life of the contract, so the remaining 60 some years, if the city wants to eliminate parking spots on a street for, you know, a dedicated bus lane to get people out of their cars, or a bike lane or pedestrian malls or any number of things they want to do that eliminate spots, they have to buy them back at the future value of the spot. It's expensive. It's a lot of money. So you're a mayor and a city council, and you're always faced with limited resources. You don't do those things, well, you know, if it's too much money. So the implication there is, you know, the reality there is that the fundamental responsibilities of a city include transportation, housing, land use, you know, doing their part for climate, getting people out of cars, all of these things. Their hands are tied. The people that are elected by the people of Chicago to run the city don't have the power to do their job. That's what I mean about, you know, it's an assault on democracy. Not exactly to your question, but, and we see those kinds of features. It's a terrible deal. Everybody hates it in Chicago. Other mayors don't understand it around the country. But the feature of those is when we codify, we hand over some authority in contracts, right? And, you know, private prisons have bed guarantees, keep the beds filled or pay anyway. Yeah. You know, to your question, again, is the more that we are, you know, this other part of the assault on democracy is what I was saying earlier is, you know, the more we are segregated, the more we are simply consumers, the more of services, the more we are stratified, which is another impact, the less we share in common. If we're not solving the same problems, we're not, you know, we don't have the same experiences, we won't solve the same problems together. You know, that gets at the heart of, our problems with our democracy right now.
Yeah. And you mentioned prisons. There are a number of state and federal prisons that are privately run. And you argue this creates pressure to lock people up for profit and creates conditions where other options become even more expensive and impractical. So elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, well, so I mentioned, say a few things. So private prisons, there are a number of states have private prisons, there are federal private prisons. There are also quite a few federal immigration detention facilities. Most of them, are private. So in their contract, we looked at many state contracts a few years back, and many of them had bed guarantees, keep the beds filled or pay anyway. Different 80%, 90%. Arizona had 100%. So there's a few things important there. One is that, so if prison populations do go down, and in fact, in Arizona, they are because of legalization of marijuana and other things, doesn't have the ability to access those resources, those savings, to spend on mental health services, job training, any number of things that would help people, coming out of prison, or getting people who shouldn't be in prison, should really be in a community mental health system. They don't have those resources. So it limits our ability. The second and sort of larger idea to point out is prisons, businesses do one thing, they sell things. And there's nothing wrong with that. We all buy things. So what do private prison companies do? They sell heads and beds. And what do they care about? They care about how many beds. They care about how much it costs to provide that service. They care about profit margin, what's left over, and they care about market share, right? So it's in their interest to have more heads and beds. So every dollar they spend, and they do spend quite a bit in politics, in lobbying, in all the things, is about increasing the number of, isn't about, again, about their sales and their profits and their costs. It makes logical sense. So they have spent decades, they don't do it as much anymore because they took some political hits for it. But, we in California have three strikes, you're out policies, strong, mandatory minimum sentences, laws that have filled up our prisons around and jails around the country, that the private prison companies played a huge role in using their political power to make those laws happen. Mm-hmm. So really important to understand that, be clear about what their interests are and what their purposes and what ours are. And they're just different things. And sometimes their interests get in the way.
Many Americans decry the regulatory power of the federal government, and former President Trump campaigned on a promise to reduce and eliminate regulations. In your book, you talk about the researcher who examined 19th century death records and extrapolated them into hypothetical 20th century that never passed laws such as, you know, 1906 Food and Drug Act, the 1938 Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act, the 1958 Food Additives Amendment. Tell us what they found the thought of safer with FDA oversight, which FDA oversight or corporate sponsored inspection, right?
Right. Well, I don't remember the specific number, but it found that, I mean, look back, there's 100 years of, increased, government regulations over health and safety from, our food is definitely safer now than it was. Our air is safer. Our workplaces are safer. Our cars, the steering wheels of cars used to impale people on impact. They don't any longer. Right. So there's many, many law, DDT is that we no longer use DDT. Right. Thalidomide was stopped from coming into the country in there by our FDA scientist, Francis Kelsey, in the 1960 or 61. So all these things are true. Now, for food, let's take food. The public doesn't grow our food, doesn't create our food, but they are responsible for keeping it safe, right? You have a law to make sure that food is produced safely, that we don't get, food illnesses, which happened all the time. And so you need to have cops on the, set those standards and then have cops on the beat, right? To make sure that, food inspectors. So two things have happened around that gives a sense of, one is that we don't have the resources. We cut the food, FSIS, Food Safety Inspection Service, which is part of the FDA. We've cut the resources to have fewer and fewer inspectors who are not able to do that, not able to inspect our food. And we've had, outbreaks of salmonella and all sorts of things that have happened. So one of the things that does happen though is corporations then, they do want a seal of approval when they put their food out on the market. They hire an independent contractor auditor to do their food safety. The problem is that that contractor to the private company, to General Mills or whoever, or the poultry processor, works for them. So they don't want to, their fingers on the scale a little bit because they don't want to give a bad, seal of approval, because they want to get hired again, right? And so that happens. They don't look carefully, and then there are outbreaks. There are stories in the book about that. The other thing that's happened is, this is legislatively, or maybe it was administratively, is that the federal government has now allowed for voluntary programs. I can't remember what the acronym is right now, but that allows companies to apply to be part of this program to self-inspect. Now there's still FSIS inspectors involved, but much fewer. So essentially the workers on the poultry processing line are responsible for inspecting the chickens, the food. They're going by at a fast rate because that's also happened. And again, if you don't watch, bad things happen, and that's exactly what's happened. So again, it's important. We have a public, our public, if you have a rule and a regulation, you have to make sure that they live up to it. And the only way to do that is by watching.
Yeah. Privatization is supported more broadly by Republicans, but historically Democrats have initiated privatization as well. And you mentioned Bill Clinton. Tell us a little bit about Bill Clinton's reform agenda, which was virtually lifted from recommendations made by Reagan's Commission on Privatization.
Yeah, well, when Bill, Reagan, everybody thinks Reagan was the, launched privatization. He actually mostly failed, but, they moved, there were, during that period, there were a lot of ideas that came out of that gave, that then Bill Clinton used. The first thing is that when he got elected, as presidents often do, but he appointed Vice President Gore to do a reinventing government commission. It was called the National Performance Review. And that's a good thing to do. You look to see if you could always, we should always be looking to see if we could do things better, right? Or, because it's a complex, big institution. But privatization was baked in deeply into that. The idea of that we should be looking for to hand off some of these things to private sector. And this idea of customers that I was mentioned earlier, that it's that we should be treating the people of, citizens as customers. And there's part of the impulse there is good. We should make sure that, we're serving well and we're listening to people. But that's, but that idea got baked in deeply, that's all we are, not citizens. But that, so The biggest thing Clinton did that kind of opened the floodgates was when welfare reform was passed, I think in 96, something around that. It part of the part TANF, part of the law, this comprehensive law, allowed for the first time the privatization of major pieces of our social safety net, of our welfare. And at the time, companies, defense contractors who were looking for new product lines after the Cold War, got into it. Lockheed Martin, Maximus, Ross Perot's company, who had big military contracts. And so it kind of opened the floodgates. And, it was actually Clinton that kind of supercharges and sort of institutionalized the ideas that came out of the Reagan administration, that we are now living with.
You write in the book that privatization received a big boost from racism. What did you mean by that?
Well, let's talk about the privatization of public education. School choice, as it's called, was a segregationist response to Brown versus Board of Education, right? So white parents in the South did not want their kids going to school with black kids. Okay, so what the states did after Brown versus Education that started to desegregate was create voucher programs, school voucher programs, where a family could take their money and go to a white flight academy or a segregation academy is what they were called, and take the money away from schools that where black kids were, and ultimately some of them were closed down. Even they closed them down. So that's it's a heart of it. Right, it's at the heart of the public education is to segregate and allow parents to, quote, choose where their kids go and who their kids could need to connect with and interact with. Now, fast forward to today, and you don't see quite the same thing, but you actually are starting to see some of the same things with the growth of charter schools and the growth of voucher school policies around the country. Lots of more conservative states are passing these laws. You're actually starting to see increasing segregation, increasing stratification. There's a school in North Carolina that was a private school, primarily a white private school, that were decided that the school, the parents decided that they no longer wanted to pay the private tuition, and they could become a charter school, because that's publicly funded. And they applied, they became a charter school, they got a federal grant, they became a charter school, now funded publicly, primarily white still. The nearby school is now more, has a higher population of black kids. And the important thing to understand there, what's really going on, is people say, but what about the schools? They need to be improved, and competition will do it, But there is no school reform effort, honest, to improve schools that includes taking away their money. And that's what happens. The money leaves this, with the kid, all the cost doesn't leave. And so you're increasingly defunding schools. Again, with that earlier, what you were talking about, that market idea, well, they'll just fail. And then that will improve the system. Well, imagine what that does to families and communities. It's completely disruptive.
Yeah. We're talking with Donald Cohen. His latest book is The Privatization of Everything: How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the hidden costs of privatization with Donald Cohen. He's the founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, a nationally based research and policy center that studies public goods and services. His book is The Privatization of Everything: How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Much of the country's infrastructure is in need of repair or replacement, everything from highways and bridges to drinking water and sewer systems. And this is happening at a time when many state and local municipalities are overstretched and citizens favor of increased taxes or taking out bonds. Privatization might start to look like a good option. So tell us about how this played out on the Indiana Toll Road.
Well, so a lot of governments around the country are looking at what's referred to as public-private partnerships, or probably as P3, to say, we don't have the resources to fix our, to upgrade our infrastructure, as you say, Mindy. And so we need to go to the private markets, the private sector to, to bring in, private capital to fix them. And when they do that, they also say, we'll let them operate them and, and maintain them for many years so they can, recoup their resources. So they did that in Indiana. I think it was Mitch Daniels, first the governor, first did, did that deal in Indiana. And, it turned out that, there's all sorts of things that happen there. I feel like, I got to say a couple other preface things. One is that they say no new taxes, but you got to pay for things. That's the sort of simple truth in the world is things cost money. And so if you're not going to get the money through taxes, where do you get it? You get it through tolls. So tolls go up, so, and then, and private capital is more expensive. So they're not going to do this because they're not going to make money. So what happens, so then, but what does happen is that they aren't making money, right? If the cars don't, there are not enough cars on the road. And when tolls go up, cars do try to find other ways to get places. So that does happen. There's a story called shunpiking in the book that you may remember. So what happened? They go bankrupt. Okay, so that it happened a lot, right? Because they weren't getting the, they say they'll share the risk if the money doesn't come in, but it turns out they can't because we still need the road. So they go bankrupt. Now, Governor Pence had the opportunity to buy back, to bring it back into a public, make it a public road. He, you may remember, he was a he had, he was a true believer in the private sector, or maybe there were other reasons, that he wanted to. And so even though two counties decided, said, no, we'll do it. We'll put together the resources to make this happen. He said, no, we'll give it to another company that paid even more for it, which is sort of still sort of mind-boggling to us. We can't quite figure out. Important thing, a couple of things to illustrate. Okay. So one is they get control, right? They get control of our stuff. There's one thing that happened when, someone's controlling our fundamental assets. There was a storm of floods in Indiana at one point after privatized. The governor at the time said, open the toll gates so people could evacuate. They got a bill afterwards from the private company. Okay, so imagine, okay, we paid them, but imagine you're a governor and you're making a choice. Do I, can I afford this or not, or save lives? You never want that in someone's head. Second thing, as I mentioned, prices went way up. The third thing that it's really important to remember, to recognize in all of those kinds of deals, especially the transit ones, is they have features in them, like the parking meter feature, but different, like non-compete clauses that prohibit the state or the county or the agency from upgrading the roads that compete with that road because it could affect ridership, and ridership is dollars. They sell cars on the roads, right? So mass transit systems, you can't do that. There's, all of every public-private partnership has those kind of features in them that, again, limit our ability to make decisions. Completely inflexible.
Let's talk to Stephen, who's giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. I think what your guest was talking about the fact that it's affecting democracy is that the less we are involved in our projects, the more it takes away from the democratic process and the quality of democracy. So I'm all in favor of that. And certainly with Zoom and everything, it becomes much easier for people to participate in those meetings and planning. But things like I think a lot of people are unaware of the possibility of public-private partnerships for the canal bridges, Cape Cod canal bridges that are in the works. So I encourage people to keep up with what's going on because otherwise decisions will be made without them, and it could be involving tolls over the bridges and so forth. And so that's just something to keep in mind, and just wanted to bring that up since using a local project as an example. Thank
Yeah,
you.
Stephen, thank you. Thank you for calling.
That's
And
that,
Stephen brings up a
yeah.
good point.
He really does. I mean, it's really important to pay attention. What happened in Chicago is nobody was looking. When you don't ask the hard questions about these deals, because they're long-term deals and they have lots of impacts beyond whether whether the bridge exists or not. And so really important to investigate and interrogate the details before the deals are done. Now, I don't know if there needs to be a toll or not, or that's up to them, but if there does need to be a toll, who gets to decide what the toll rates are? These are sort of the questions you got to ask. And I, you know, the thing I, what I was kind of to add on to what I was saying earlier is things cost money. You may have to borrow money. The easy part is borrowing money to build the bridge, say. The hard part's paying it back. And there's only one place you get that money, and that's us. Taxes, tolls, or fees. You pay through taxes, we're sharing the burden. You pay through tolls, it's individual burden. Or some, or you could do a combination.
Yeah. So how can we reinsert the public in the decisions that lead to privatization?
I think a couple things. One of which is, we need to, there's an idea level. We need to sort of knock down a little bit, or at least interrogate, you know, when they say cheaper, better, faster, more efficient, you know, because that's sort of in the wind, right? It's in our air, right? We breathe it. When we say, and I'll just stay a moment on this, when they say efficiency, you know, the private sector is more efficient, that means they're going to do something for less. And remember, they have to, you know, they have profit, they have other money that's got to leave the service. If they're going to do something for less, you have to ask the question, what are you going to spend less on? You're going to have fewer workers, you're going to have lower quality equipment, you're going to pay the employees less with fewer benefits, that affects us all. So it's really important to get those ideas about, you know, competition and efficiency, is interrogate them deeply. The second thing is at that level is to remember that, you know, the public is all around us. We have to kind of remember that, right? And the public purpose is all around us, health and environment. The next, you know, then I'd say is what's, you know, it's not about who provides the service. It could be private, it could be public, it could be nonprofit. It's about who's in control, right? It's about whether we set standards, right? And whether we have cops on the beat to make sure those standards are used. Governments in America spend from school boards to, you know, to the federal government, spend $2 trillion on procurement, on contracts of different kinds, from paperclips to bombers to prisons to whatever. That's a lot of power we have to use to set and enforce those standards. Job standards, because in fact, what happened, you know, often what happens is jobs, you know, quality goes down, wages go from $25 an hour to $15 an hour or 12 in many places, you know, so we're helping to increase inequality, which is the big one. So we should be using that power and the other powers we have to at least do no harm to the big ones, but absolutely to make progress. And when I say the big ones, I mean inequality and climate and democracy and racism, you know, the things that you know, that really are you know, are existential threats to all of us. And so I think that's super important. And, you know, in the end, you gotta pay attention.
Yeah. It happens so often where people say, how did that happen? Right. To Stephen's point about being involved before the decisions are made rather than later going, how did we get here? So as we move beyond the pandemic, cash-strapped governments are going to be pressed to pay for public goods. How do we encourage them not to resort to privatization?
And we've done a bunch of document organizationally. We've done a bunch of documents and really sort of questions to ask when you outsource. I mean, the problem is, you know, a lot of the problem happens when something is privatized because, you know, I'm using Chicago again as an example. It's because they don't ask the hard questions. It comes in and says cheap. You know, listen, if you're a mayor and you've got a lot on your plate, and someone, you know, walks in, you know, a company, you know, a global company walks in and says cheaper, better, faster, and, you know, and by the way, the market's a better instrument anyway, and the private sector is better anyway, and it's one less problem you have, you know, I can appreciate the sentiment to say, okay, well, you take it, okay. But then, you know, as it often in sales jobs, we get enamored by the pretty things. Every time there's a private investor, you know, for infrastructure that comes in and we get a call and it says, you know, they want to do a public-private partnership and that's, they're walking around City Hall or the state office. My first question is, have they shown you the pretty pictures yet? They always have renderings, always. And they're gorgeous and they're exciting. So you have to ask those hard questions. You have to think forward beyond the term of the elected official. You have to say, what's going to happen? You know, do we lose the ability to make decisions that we may need to make in 20 years? Are we impacting the community because the jobs aren't going to be as good, so people will be able to afford a house? You have to do that for all ages. And again, I'll say it again, you have to remember, there's no free lunch. Yeah. Someone's going to pay.
The book ends with a call to recognize the positive impacts of government and how important the public sector is to our lives. So we'll talk a little about that in some ways that we can do this.
A little bit like I was saying earlier is if you look around, you just turn your head, the public is all around us. Remember, we're in this intensely anti-government environment. I mean, worse than ever in my life because of all the insanity that's going on in the country at this point is, the government's inefficient, they're corrupt. We're swimming in a sea of negative attitudes about government that in part are manufactured, are created as a propaganda victory over the last 40 years in some ways, but in part because we've, weakened it so that it does something, so that we do have legitimate complaints about the quality of the service. And so, but it's important to say that it's not all bad. I mean, we all know teachers. We all know we have, people, teachers and parents with kids in school, and they come home and they did something cool. It's happening in classrooms, in public classrooms around the country. I've talked to principals, actually superintendents of schools all over the country who complain people don't understand it. They all think our schools are terrible. I say to them, listen, there's cool things happening in every one of your districts in classrooms. Talk about them. And so we need to be talking about them. I've spent time with public sector workers in New York State recently, some scientists and probation officers, really a mix, and say, you're all proud of what you do. When you explain it to me, when I don't know what you do, it's pretty inspiring stuff, but everybody hates you. You got to talk, because you're the lazy bureaucratic public sector. You got to talk about those things because it literally is all around us.
Just have a couple minutes less, and while there are vast amounts of power and money focused on privatizing public goods, and you just think of the lobbyists and stuff you're up against, you remain hopeful that the public can prevail, right?
I do, and because I've seen it. Baltimore, Veolia, a major global water company, tried to many years over and over again tried to privatize the water system in Baltimore, failed. Citizen action. Some people were saying no, and they ultimately collected signatures, put a measure on the ballot, and banned it forever. Many local communities are cities are establishing municipal broadband. I want us to have municipal broadband because we all get it. Broadband's just as important as the roads at this point. Telecom companies have gone to state legislators to prevent and prohibit cities and local communities from doing that, so they didn't want the competition. But in Colorado, they allowed cities to take a public vote. It was prohibited, but if the voters voted for it, they could have it. Cities across Colorado have voted for it in overwhelming numbers. So people want it, and to water again, lots of communities privatize their water and they're bringing it back. Both, and for two reasons. One is it didn't work. They ended up paying more, they could save money. But more importantly, because they thought, we ought to have control over this. This is ours.
Donald Cohen, founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, an Oakland-based national research and policy center that studies public goods and services. His book is The Privatization of Everything: How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. We'll have a link with more information about the book and Donald Cohen at our website, capeandislands.org. Donald, thanks so much for being with us. Very interesting conversation. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much. Look forward to getting out to the Cape someday.
All right. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.